From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review Ralph Breaks the Internet, the sequel to Wreck-It Ralph from Disney Animation. Creed 2, also a sequel to the very popular film that starred Michael B. Jordan and Sylvester Stallone. Both of them are back. And we'll also hear about Roma from writer-director Alfonso Cuarón. It gets a theatrical release in advance of its Netflix streaming.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight presenting The Favorite, a tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman as Queen Anne and Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz as the women of the court vying for her favor, in select theaters Friday.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle on this Thanksgiving weekend. It's such a pleasure to have you with us. A lot of movies because of the holiday coming out, and I think we're going to hear some high praise for some of them. Joining us this week, critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of What the Flick podcast at ChristyLemire.com. Also, Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times film critic and the animation authority from Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, author Charles Solomon. First up, the animation adventure comedy Ralph Breaks the Internet, a sequel to the very popular Disney animation film of a few years ago. Phil Johnston co-directs with Rich Moore, also co-wrote the screenplay. John C. Reilly and Sarah Silverman's voices star in the film. Also a star-studded cast, including Gal Gadot, Taraji P. Henson, Jack McBrayer, and more.
Oh, hello, sir.
Interesting. You don't seem to have a search history.
Well, let's start one for you. What can Nosemore help you find today?
Umbrella. Umbridge. Umami.
No.
Noah's Ark. No doubt. Nordstrom Rack. Ergonomics. Urban Outfitters. Cool.
Looks like no one put Humpty Dumpty together again. This guy's a little soft-boiled.
I'm pretty sure he's just trying to guess what you're gonna say.
Yes, I'm sorry, but my autofill is a touch aggressive today.
I really enjoyed the first Wreck-It Ralph. Charles, what did you think of Ralph Breaks the Internet?
Well, I liked the first one, too, and I didn't particularly like this one. I just think it has a lot of problems. The basic premise is Ralph and Vanellope are besties now, and everything seems hunky-dory until her game breaks. It's an old game, so they have to go into the Internet to try and find a missing part to repair it. And once they go into the Internet, I think they get into a lot of trouble. In the first place, everything is so busy. They cannot compose a shot. There's so much background, so many elements moving, so many things happening. Your eye has no place to focus. There's also a great deal of what has been dubbed corporate fan service, in that there's Google, there's Twitter, there's eBay. There are all these real companies. And it feels like product placement and merchandising. Then when they go to Disney, I think things take a turn for the snarky, where the Disney princesses are so many valley girls in sweatsuits, and these are characters that Disney goes to such lengths to protect and promote and merchandise. And you begin to wonder, well, who are they making fun of? The same way in Hercules, when Herc talks about becoming, look, I'm an action figure, but you could buy action figures of him even in the lobby of some theaters. So
it's a contradictory.
Making fun of? The climax feels like it's taken from Hosoda's Summer Wars, where you have the hero and heroine fighting this enormous entity made of clouds of individual avatars. But in Summer Wars, the heroine uses intelligence and courage and talent to defeat the monster with a little help from her friends. Here, they kind of talk it to death. And the film, it just didn't work for me.
Ralph Breaks the Internet. Justin.
I liked this better than Charles, but the elements of it that kind of rankled me a little bit, I'm in agreement on. Or maybe I even see it a different way, because I didn't mind the sort of bombardment that I feel like that's kind of a true representation of what it is like to browse the internet nowadays, a kind of our 24/7 digital world that we all live in. And this movie is a satire of that. My problem is that I think sometimes the movie, you know, it's hard to do that without feeling like product placement, as Charles says. And I think it lapses into it almost becomes kind of what it's indicting. With the Disney part, I have to say, I really laughed pretty hard at the princess scene. I do think it's really funny and one of the more memorable scenes I've seen in an animated, or certainly a studio animation this year. However, I also, you know, I feel like it's Disney. You can't get away just from just the sort of behemoth that Disney represents. And so even when they're pretending to send themselves up, they're really asserting their kind of corporate supremacy here. So even that rang a little smug to me. I also just find, and I think I'm saying that, you know, John C. Reilly is a wonderful actor, and he's given so many great...
From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review Ralph Breaks the Internet, the sequel to Wreck-It Ralph from Disney Animation. Creed 2, also a sequel to the very popular film that starred Michael B. Jordan and Sylvester Stallone. Both of them are back. And we'll also hear about Roma from writer-director Alfonso Cuarón. It gets a theatrical release in advance of its Netflix streaming.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight presenting The Favorite, a tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman as Queen Anne and Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz as the women of the court vying for her favor in select theaters Friday.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle on this Thanksgiving weekend. It's such a pleasure to have you with us. A lot of movies because of the holiday coming out, and I think we're going to hear some high praise for some of them. Joining us this week, critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of What the Flick podcast at ChristyLemire.com. Also, Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times film critic and the animation authority from Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, author Charles Solomon. First up, the animation adventure comedy Ralph Breaks the Internet, a sequel to the very popular Disney animation film of a few years ago. Phil Johnston co-directs with Rich Moore, also co-wrote the screenplay. John C. Reilly and Sarah Silverman's voices star in the film. Also a star-studded cast, including Gal Gadot, Taraji P. Henson, Jack McBrayer, and more.
Oh, hello, sir. Interesting. You don't seem to have a search history. Well, let's start one for you. What can Nosemore help you find today? Umbrella, Umbridge, Umami?
No.
Noah's Ark, no doubt. Nordstrom Rack. Ergonomics, Urban Outfitters, Cool.
Looks like no one put Humpty Dumpty together again. This guy's a little soft-boiled.
I'm pretty sure he's just trying to guess what you're gonna say.
Yes, I'm sorry, but my autofill is a touch aggressive today.
I really enjoyed the first Wreck-It Ralph. Charles, what did you think of Ralph Breaks the Internet?
Well, I liked the first one, too, and I didn't particularly like this one. I just think it has a lot of problems. The basic premise is Ralph and Vanellope are besties now, and everything seems hunky-dory until her game breaks. It's an old game, so they have to go into the Internet to try and find a missing part to repair it. And once they go into the Internet, I think they get into a lot of trouble. In the first place, everything is so busy. They cannot compose a shot. There's so much background, so many elements moving, so many things happening. Your eye has no place to focus. There's also a great deal of what has been dubbed corporate fan service, in that there's Google, there's Twitter, there's eBay. There are all these real companies. And it feels like product placement and merchandising. Then when they go to Disney, I think things take a turn for the snarky, where the Disney princesses are so many valley girls in sweatsuits, and these are characters that Disney goes to such lengths to protect and promote and merchandise. And you begin to wonder, well, who are they making fun of? The same way in Hercules, when Herc talks about becoming... Look, I'm an action figure, but you could buy action figures of him even in the lobby of some theater. So
it's a contradictory.
Making fun of? The climax feels like it's taken from Hosoda's Summer Wars, where you have the hero and heroine fighting this enormous entity made of clouds of individual avatars. But in Summer Wars, the heroine uses intelligence and courage and talent to defeat the monster with a little help from her friends. Here, they kind of talk it to death. And the film, it just didn't work for me.
Ralph breaks the internet. Justin.
I liked this better than Charles, but the elements of it that kind of rankled me a little bit, I'm in agreement on. Or maybe I even see it a different way, because I didn't mind the sort of bombardment that I feel like that's kind of a true representation of what it is like to browse the internet nowadays, a kind of our 24/7 digital world that we all live in. And this movie is a satire of that. My problem is that I think sometimes the movie, you know, it's hard to do that without feeling like product placement, as Charles says. And I think it lapses into it almost becomes kind of what it's indicting. With the Disney part, I have to say, I really laughed pretty hard at the princess scene. I do think it's really funny and one of the more memorable scenes I've seen in an animated, or certainly a studio animation this year. However, I also, you know, I feel like it's Disney. You can't get away just from just the sort of behemoth that Disney represents. And so even when they're pretending to send themselves up, they're really asserting their kind of corporate supremacy here. So even that rang a little smug to me. I also just find, and I think, I'm saying that, you know, John C. Reilly is a wonderful actor, and he's given so many great performances this year, including in movies like The Sisters Brothers. I found Ralph kind of insufferable in this particular go-round, and I think that's partly by design, because the movie is in some ways a send-up of his toxic male insecurity and his friend, you know, he's sort of dominating, he's trying to control Vanellope and sort of control their friendship, and that's a theme. So the movie, but I couldn't bear his company in this one, and I actually wanted more of Sarah Silverman's.
All right, what did you think, Christy?
I have to preface everything I'm about to say with a disclosure that Phil Johnston, who co-wrote and co-directed it, is a really close friend of mine and of our families. We've known him for 15 years. Having said that, I genuinely really enjoyed this, and I'm very impressed with the film's ability to have its cake and eat it too. That princess scene, I cannot believe what they get away with in making fun of just the most sacred tropes, you know, that have, as Charles puts it, they protect it ordinarily. So I was amazed that they were making fun of the formulaic nature of all of these characters. There's a song in it that Vanellope sings. She gets her big princess ballad like every princess gets. And that makes fun of the structure of the princess kind of ballad. And I was amazed by that.
While staring at important water.
Right. She has to look at her reflection in the water. It does create the sensation of the bombardment of the internet. And that is by design. And that absolutely makes sense. And it's a lot of fun. And I think it's probably tailored to younger viewers in a lot of ways, who will be able to have their synapses fire fast enough that they can catch it all, or they're going to watch it repeatedly and check them all out. But by the end, because the characters of Vanellope and Ralph are so well drawn, and as you point out, Justin, so beautifully acted, there is real emotion that sneaks up on you by the end. It's all about Vanellope asserting herself and becoming her own person, and that's, it's applicable as a message, whether it's, you know, with a parent saying goodbye to a child going off to college, or saying goodbye to a boyfriend who's toxic, or just letting people out of your life who are no good for you anymore. So I found that message to be pretty relevant in a variety of contexts. I realize he's a really close friend of mine, so no one's going to believe what I'm saying here. But I believe in myself, which is what matters, and I learned that from Vanellope.
We believe you. We don't agree with you, but we believe you.
I mean, I had a really good time.
Ralph Breaks the Internet, a Disney animation sequel starring the voices of John C. Reilly, Sarah Silverman, Gal Gadot. It's rated PG in wide release. Phil Johnston and Rich Moore are the directors. Creed 2, also a sequel to the 2015 Ryan Coogler film. Stephen Caple Jr. directs this time. The screenplay is co-written by Sylvester Stallone and Jewel Taylor. Michael B. Jordan stars alongside Stallone. The character of Adonis Creed is back as he trains for his latest big fight, a matchup with Rocky IV villain Ivan Drago's son, Victor.
You don't think I can beat him? Is that what you're trying
no.
to say?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I'm not going to be here forever.
And what's that supposed to mean?
It means you got to do some smart thinking.
Oh, you want to talk about smart decisions, Rock? You in this house all alone. Who's been taking care of you? Me. I've been here for you. Who else you got?
Creed 2, rated PG-13, Justin.
We were just talking before the show about how much we all enjoyed the first Creed a few years ago.
Absolutely. One of my favorite films that year.
And, you know, I don't think this is as good as that, but I was pleasantly surprised by how good it was, especially because it does have a new director, Stephen Caple Jr. who does a very capable job. I'm sorry. So sorry, Mr. Capel. I shouldn't have done that.
You should.
Ryan Coogler is, you know, who directed the first one and is still in a producing or executive producing capacity here, and he still brings that very, you know, he brought such a freshness to the Rocky legend, to the conventions of the boxing genre, and I still think that the seeds that he planted in that movie are very much in flower here, specifically just with Michael B. Jordan is just, I think, arguably the most charismatic American actor working today, or certainly of his generation. You put this next to his great performance in Black Panther, where there's those two roles are sort of in conversation about an orphan who goes on to fulfill some kind of warped version of his father's legacy. It's actually really interesting, and yet those performances and those characters could not be more different. And so here, and again, the focus is very much not just on his sort of rise and fall and rise. Once again, still Sylvester Stallone, you know, as Rocky, of course, you know, mentoring him, not mentoring him, every kind of feint, every plot development in this movie, you can see coming a mile away, and yet I think it's something about the sincerity with which the filmmakers approach it that I didn't mind a second. It's one of those things where, you know, we were talking a few weeks ago about Bohemian Rhapsody versus this, why convention can sometimes work, and I think that in this one, it just really works.
Creed 2, what'd you think, Christy?
It's solid, yeah. I mean, Creed was such a revelation that it would be tough to match that, and this doesn't quite get there. It gives the people what they want. It's got multiple montages. You want a training montage.
In the desert.
Multiple.
Slow-mo punches.
Yes, and Michael B. Jordan alone, or with Tessa Thompson, just have enormous chemistry with each other. I love that her character is so much more than just the girl, so much more than just the supportive girlfriend. She becomes a lot more than that in this film, and she is as strong as he is. There's a great tug of nostalgia to see Sylvester Stallone return to this role. He plays off of Michael B. Jordan so beautifully, but a lot of it plays like fan fiction. It's like, okay, what if, like, Apollo Creed's kid had to fight Ivan Drago's kid? What would happen? Who would
Christy,
win?
What's the matter with that? That sounds
it plays
absolutely,
like that.
This it does
happens
sound
every
ridiculous.
Day. I guess.
Yeah, but Drago's kid might as well have bad guy stenciled across his front. Yeah. You know, he's not attractive. He's at least 75 pounds heavier than Jordan, which makes the fight a little improbable. He's taught by his father to be mean. His mother is mean and abandoned him when although he's in the Ukraine, he's somehow Russian, and his father was the cream of Russian society until he lost. I would watch Michael B. Jordan do pretty much anything, as the other said. He's such a charismatic and effective actor. He can be discombobulated. He can be heroic. He can do anything. But there are things, I wonder about in this, like why does Apollo Creed's widow live essentially in a palace with an enormous trophy room, and Rocky Balboa lives in a crummy little place in Philadelphia and has a two-bit restaurant?
That's who he wants to be.
Yeah.
That's his choice.
He doesn't have, yeah, he didn't want the trophy room.
He's Rocky, Charles.
Yeah.
He's true to himself.
And again, I liked Sylvester Stallone better than I thought I could in these two movies.
Well, he also, I think, steps back a little bit here. I mean, he was, you know, nominated for Supporting Actor Oscar for the previous one and came very close to winning, I think. But I don't think that will necessarily happen this time because there is a sense in which he's sort of graciously ceding the spotlight ever more to Adonis Creed. And that's very touching, actually.
Creed 2, the film, rated PG-13. It's in wide release, starring Michael B. Jordan and Sylvester Stallone. Stephen Caple Jr. directs, the screenplay by Stallone and Jewel Taylor. The Favorite, from director Yorgos Lanthimos, who, if I'm not mistaken, typically directs his own screenplays. But here, The Favorite is written by Deborah Davis and Tony McNamara. It stars Olivia Colman, Emma Stone, and Rachel Weisz. Christy, what'd you think of The Favorite?
This might be my favorite movie of the year, with or without the letter U in it. Yorgos Lanthimos usually directs screenplays that he writes with Efthymios Philippou, but
good.
This
like
thank you very
lobster,
much.
Yeah.
Like the lobster,
Killing
of
a
Sacred
favorite.
Deer, right? Killing of a Sacred Deer and Dogtooth. This might be Yorgos Lanthimos's most accessible film, and superficially it seems like his most conventional film, but it is not. It looks like a really stuffy and safe period drama, but it still has that bite and that wit that you want from him. It is lush and gorgeous and surprising and weird and just a blast. Olivia Colman doing the best work of her long career. She is so underappreciated, you guys, and she has never had a role like this that allows her to show off everything she can do. She plays Queen Anne. It is early 18th century England. She's this really mercurial, needy, demanding, cruel ruler. But really, she's just the figurehead because her longtime best friend and more, played by Rachel Weisz, really runs things and is her right-hand woman. Emma Stone comes in as a servant, this upstart servant who winds her way into their world. And it's about this power struggle between these three women. It is gorgeous. It is deliciously mean, but there's also an affection and a sympathy for the vulnerabilities of these women, too. It's not mean toward them. I loved it. It's a blast.
I need to break, Charles. Okay. We're going to hear what Justin has to say about it coming up. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope to see you coming up for our next Film Week screening series. We'll be at the Theater at Ace Hotel Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, 1 o'clock. The Artist takes us back to Hollywood during the transitional period from silent to talking pictures, filmed all in Los Angeles. We'd love to see you there. Tickets, kpecc.org/in-person. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon, Justin Chang, and Christy Lemire. We're right in the middle of reviewing The Favorite from director Yorgos Lanthimos. Deborah Davis and Tony McNamara wrote The Favorite, which stars Olivia Colman, Emma Stone, and Rachel Weisz. Justin, what'd you think of it?
I agree with everything that Christy just said. I think this is an amazing movie, and I think it's Lanthimos's absolutely one of his best films, possibly his best. And it's also, I think, the best historical costume drama, you know, the best period piece I've seen in ages. And you wouldn't necessarily think from Lanthimos's earlier films that he would be a natural fit for this material, but he absolutely is. And it makes sense because movies like The Lobster and Dogtooth, there's always these satires where he's like looking at these people under glass and he's kind of observing the absurdity of, you know, human rituals and human behavior. And so what better, you know, petri dish than the 18th century British monarchy? And, you know, and yet, as Christy said, you know, there's so much sympathy here, and it's funny. It does, you know, it's incredibly. The pleasure of this movie is just watching these power plays unfold. You could watch these women scheme and snipe at each other for 5 hours, and yet it's also just paced like a whirlwind. And he really draws, you know, as beautiful as the furnishings are, as gorgeous as Sandy Powell's costumes are, the camera moves with this like velocity from one end of the room. It's like a very active, kinetic, vibrant movie. It's not just this. It's, I mean, there are moments where it's kind of a bit more painterly, and there's these sort of tableaus, and there's a stillness to it. But he gets an incredible amount of momentum out of this material, and the performances are just could not be better.
Is Sarah supposed to be Sarah Churchill?
Yes, absolutely. Lady Sarah Churchill, the Duchess of Marlborough. And this is, of course, based on a real-life episode. You know, certainly embellished and interpreted very freely, but drawn also from very intimate letters between the Queen and Lady Sarah.
Yes. Chris.
I was going to say, you mentioned really fast that Sandy Powell's clothes are gorgeous, of course, but they're a great example of how he keeps you guessing with unexpected flourishes here and there. They're not the kind of dresses you always see in this kind of film, or the makeup is like a little bit smudged, or the wigs are a little bit messy, like it's imperfect in all the best possible tactile ways.
There are a lot of anachronistic touches to it, and a lot of the design, it has a surreal quality, almost like reminiscent of like Wonderland, like a Lewis Carroll's Wonderland. It's really, yes, really good.
We're talking about The Favorite, which is rated R. It's at ArcLight Hollywood, the Landmark in West L.A., from director Yorgos Lanthimos. Roma, you've probably already heard quite a bit about it, as it was a smash in its festival showings. Writer-director Alfonso Cuarón, who seemingly can't make a bad film, has what many consider to be the pinnacle of his distinguished career. Roma based on his experiences growing up in Mexico City, stars Yalitza Aparicio and Nancy Garcia Garcia. Christy, what'd you think?
So writer, director, and also cinematographer Alfonso Cuarón, because he shot this in exquisite black and white. It is stunningly beautiful and so achingly personal. I love this movie. I just said that The Favorite is my favorite movie of the year, but this is probably a close second. This is really up there for me as well. And it is just this beautifully vivid and subtly touching slice of life. And like from the opening shot, you know you are just in the hands of a master. It's like this 4-minute long shot of just the cobblestone on a driveway and soap bubbles being swept back and forth over them. And you see the reflection of an airplane in the puddle of water as the plane goes by overhead, and just so many beautiful little touches. This is about a family in Mexico City and about the woman played by Yalitza Aparicio in an incredible debut performance. She is their maid. Her name is Cleo, but she's also a member of the family. And it kind of just feels like nothing happens. It's day in and day out. And then things happen. And they are stunningly emotional. I found myself in a couple different scenes, just my entire body was gripped with tension. And then in one in particular, I just started sobbing uncontrollably, and it was not pretty. This is a Netflix release. It's also coming out theatrically. I urge everyone listening to this, please see it on a screen if you can.
It was shot to be appreciated on a big screen.
It's gorgeous. So if you can see it on a screen, great. If you're watching it on Netflix, watch it any way you can. But if you can see it on a screen in Los Angeles someplace, please do.
Roma from Alfonso Cuarón. Justin.
Yeah, I would encourage everyone to see this movie on the big screen if you can. It's not easy for everyone. And it's funny. I love Alfonso Cuarón. I think he's a great filmmaker. I have seen this movie twice. I look forward to a third. I think everyone should see it, study it, bask in it, lose themselves in it if they can. I found myself wrestling with this film in a way I didn't expect. And I sometimes am even wondering if it's that kind of masterpiece oversold syndrome you have. I actually personally don't think it's the pinnacle of Cuarón's work. And I think that it's everything I sort of wanted it to be. And yet I was still sort of wondering why am I not losing myself in this? Because I love so many of the things that he is ostensibly doing. I love distance. I love austerity. I love observational drama where life is just unfolding and the movie is trying to acclimatize you just to the rhythms of everyday life. There is something where I don't know. I think Alfonso Cuarón loves these. This cannot be a more personal story to him. And he recreated his house like with pitch perfect. Like I think 70% accuracy. They said they even got a percentage of like the house. They found a house and they rebuilt his childhood basically. And this is a tribute to Cleo as Yalitza Aparicio, who does give a wonderful performance. The woman who raised him. It's so personal, and yet it's viewing her. It's not from her perspective. It's almost as if he's looking back at her and trying to. It's almost like a conversation between the two. And so the camera just sort of is watching. And yet I find that I think as much as he loves this character and as much as he loves this milieu, I think he loves his aesthetic techniques a little bit more. And I found them almost like showily unshowy. You know, it's like the guy who can't stop bragging about how humble he is. It's weird. I know. And I reserve the right. I still, because I think this movie is a remarkable, extraordinary achievement. I think everyone should see it. I look forward to seeing it because it's one I wrestle with. And I think it's one that, you know, its reputation so precedes it that I'm being a little hard on it.
But the unshowy showiness is in service of the story, right? So
sometimes it is.
And speaking of the house, I mean, he will do these long tracking shots through the house from one room to the next. And that tells a story of what is happening with every single member of that family in every single room in that house. The scene at the beach, which is the one long shot at the beach, tells a story of where they all are in the tumultuousness of that period of the family's life. So I would say it's germane to the storytelling, and it's also dazzling.
It is germane. It's dazzling. I mean, and this gets very abstract. I think watching it, you know, because you're so, and I love movies where it's the movements of the camera and what you're supposed to be looking at is a little bit indeterminate. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, Vittorio De Sica style kind of neorealism here, and that there's like kind of art, you know, more recent international art cinema like Hou Hsiao-hsien or even Edward Yang or something. There's a lot of influences here that he's distilling, and I love that idea. I love exactly what you described, like using visuals to tell the story. I just think there are some times where even I'm trying to lose myself, and it should feel like these things are happening spontaneously. And even in that ocean scene, and even in the scene where that also reduced me to tears, Christy, I will say,
totally,
both times I saw it, that scene absolutely. I feel the orchestration. I feel, I look at, I start admiring the choreography of these events, and I think, I shouldn't be admiring the choreography.
Yes, you should. He's really good at his job.
I think so. I think there's, I admired it in Gravity, and there it's like, you know, in Gravity and Children of Men.
I was going to say the Children of Men. Wonderful. I just rewatched that again, and
yeah.
Great
film. But Justin, if you're looking at an amazing painting, you're also aware of the brushwork and the composition and the use of color. At the same time, you're appreciating, you're gaining the aesthetic experience.
I hear what Justin said. I haven't seen Roma yet, but I have that that experience of films that I admire, but that I'm so sort of looking at the execution of the art that it distances me from the story itself.
Yeah. Now, it can get in the way when you look and say, oh, he's hot-dogging here.
Yeah, we're talking about Roma, and we all have to see it. Clearly, that's all there is to it. Preferably at the Landmark in West Los Angeles. It will start streaming mid-December on Netflix. Alfonso Cuarón, the writer-director, and you can hear Cuarón talk about the making of this very personal film with The Frame's John Horn. Just visit our Film Week page at kpcc.org. We've got a link to John's interview. Shoplifters, a Japanese drama from writer-director Hirokazu Koreeda. The film stars Lily Frankie and Sakura Ando. It's rated R. Justin?
This is a wonderful film. It won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. It was a surprise winner, partly because Koreeda is one of the most kind of roundly admired figures in world cinema, but he's also someone whose work, if you're familiar with it, can be very easy to take for granted. He makes very formally modest but emotionally rich, beautifully textured family portraits. They're not loud films. They don't scream at you. They're very quiet. This movie, Shoplifters, operates according to the same principle. It starts off with a young boy shoplifting from a grocery store in Tokyo, and with, you know, while his what seems to be his father is watching, standing guard. And so, and then you meet the rest of the family. There are about five of them. They become six when they take in a young girl living in this very cramped, very squalid apartment. And there's a real sense of mystery to this film as you follow their day-to-day struggles to survive. They all have jobs, but that don't make very much money. Shoplifting and just petty thievery is very much part of their survival. But you have all these questions about who are these people? How did they come together? Because after a while, you realize they're not all blood related, and in fact, most of them are not. And so Koreeda is just, I mean, Shoplifters is you know, obviously the title of the movie and the subject of the movie. There's a sneakiness to this film, that the way it kind of sneaks into your heart in a way, and sort of the way it sort of doles out these revelations. I watched this movie for the first time, and I thought, again, I was sort of watching this lovely, gentle Koreeda film, and it just blindsided me just how emotional it got by the end.
And I'm sure it's my ignorance, but I just don't think of Japan in its low-crime culture as having shoplifters. Yeah, I mean, every country, I'm sure, does, but...
That's something that's even been coming into anime, that while American animated features have been ignoring the recession and recovering from it, the Japanese have been tackling it with characters who are just trying to get by. And students were hoping, well, I hope someday to have a job where I'll be able to get married and have one kid. I don't want to be rich. This is all I can aspire to.
We're talking about Shoplifters. What do you think, Christy?
I loved it, too. We were talking about Roma a second ago and how Roma is showily unshowy. This is unshowy but devastating emotionally, and it really does creep up on you. You do wonder who they are and how they are connected, but not in a distracting way, because you're so immersed in the day in and day out of how they survive. And there's just this wonderful, touching humanism. Koreeda doesn't condemn or judge anybody for the crimes they commit, for the decisions they make. They make some tough decisions in the name of survival quite often, and all you can do is feel for them. Having said that, there are these small moments of joy and hope that will just wreck you, moments of kindness that come out of nowhere. And this movie is so beautifully understated that by the end, when heavy-duty stuff happens, when actual narrative developments happen, you're just floored. He's laid the groundwork for you. You feel like you are a part of these people, and you're blown away.
Yeah. Sounds like a truly great film.
It's lovely.
It really is. And really quickly to your question, Larry, yeah, about that, you know, Koreeda has talked about this a little bit. You know, because some people have taken him to task for showing sympathy to criminals. And his response has been, you know, sort of like, why do we, you know, we must judge the crime, but we must also judge the society that produce the circumstances that, you know, that turns
led to the crime.
Exactly. And so his it's very, you know, he's always been a humanist, but I think there's a real social justice driving thrust to this movie as well.
Shoplifters, the film from Japanese writer-director Hirokazu Koreeda. It's rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles and the Arclight in Hollywood. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about Robin Hood, latest version of the adventure. Also, the documentary that we have been waiting decades to see. It was made right here in Los Angeles. It was the live recording of the double album by Aretha Franklin and the Reverend James Cleveland and the Southern California Community Choir. It's one of my beloved albums on my Spotify list, too. The Amazing Grace recording of Aretha Franklin. We finally get to see that live recording in the documentary Amazing Grace. So we'll hear all about that coming up. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back after this.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, a royal tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman, Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz, Nicholas Hoult, Joe Alwyn, and Mark Gatiss in select theaters Friday.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Christy Lemire, Justin Chang, and Charles Solomon. Next up, The Adventure Robin Hood, starring Taron Egerton, Jamie Foxx, and Ben Mendelsohn. Otto Bathurst is the director, and the screenwriters Ben Chandler and David James Kelly. Justin, what do you think of this telling of Robin Hood?
I think it's pretty terrible, with a few redeeming, possibly unintended pleasures. You know, the Robin Hood legend has obviously been filmed numerous times, the best one still being the Errol Flynn, Olivia de Havilland version. This movie is very much of the moment, I feel, a strained piece of revisionism that tries to bring a lot of flashy, up-to-the-minute sensibilities to this material. It's like, it's a Christopher Nolan, Bruce Wayne-style origin story 1 minute, and then it's got a lot of incomprehensible action sequences that are clogged with CGI. It has like bow and arrow combat where every arrow hits its target with the destructive force of an assault rifle. And it's a shame because it does have a very appealing cast. Robin Hood, or Robin of Locksley, is played by Taron Egerton, who's very likable from the Kingsman movies. Eve Hewson is good as Marion, who's this poor woman. He meets her, you know, while she's trying to steal a horse from his stable. Little John is this Moor warrior who's played by Jamie Foxx, who just looks very unhappy throughout. And I like Jamie Foxx, yeah. Who doesn't like Jamie Foxx. Ben Mendelsohn is having Ben Mendelsohn is having a much better time as the Sheriff of Nottingham, who, you know, I just kept looking at his coats. I mean, I cared less and less about what's happening in the story and just looking at his wardrobe, which has, you know, this beautiful sort of silvery shawl cut kind of jacket that's like one of sort of many anachronistic touches in the design and in the fashion. You know, the movie is trying to put this interesting spin on it, but it just, you know, this sort of, this is not your grandfather's Robin Hood kind of thing, but it's just so pummeling and relentlessly pumped up. It doesn't have any vision. It just has a lot of attitude.
And what kind of soundtrack? I'm trying to picture the music.
Oh, gosh.
What you're describing.
Yeah, it's pretty, this kind of, I'm having trouble recalling in great detail. It is sort of
memorable
pummeling.
Soundtrack.
It is this drone, if I recall. Sort of.
It looks like that Guy Ritchie King Arthur from a couple years ago.
It's very much in the same vein as that kind of, you know, every once in a few years, every year or so, it feels like one of these franchises has to be resuscitated.
Robin Hood in wide release, rated PG-13. Also this week, the documentary that's been decades in the waiting, Amazing Grace, which shows us the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in Los Angeles, where in January 1972, Aretha Franklin recorded with Reverend James Cleveland and the Southern California Community Choir the classic double album set, Billboard-topping recording, Amazing Grace. Franklin delayed the release of this for financial reasons, as I recall. Justin, is the film worth the wait?
It's extraordinary. I mean, and I was at the 2015 Telluride Film Festival when we were all set to see Amazing Grace, I think either that night or the next morning, and they were saying, it's going to show. And we're got that, you know, no, it's not. And the judge blocked it, and it kept from showing. So now, 3 years later, you know, and of course, shortly after Franklin's death in August, the Alan Elliott, who was the producer and spearheaded the restoration effort, showed it to her family. They loved it, and they agreed. They gave it their blessing.
So her heir is finally signed off.
Signed off, yes. Now, the movie doesn't have a distributor as of yet, and I think they're going to find one or get around that somehow. It is playing a week-long run here. But and I do, again, urge people to go out and see it because, I mean, she shot – Sydney Pollack shot the film on 16mm cameras, and it was all done, of course, over two nights at the New Temple Baptist Missionary Church in Watts. It's a church service, and it's also a recording session, and it's a concert. It's a revival, and it's just – you're seeing this transcendent artist, you know, in her – in what feels like just could not be more her element. The music is wonderful. You know, if you've listened to the album, it's wonderful, but it's amazing to have the visual record as well. And what's remarkable is that even though, you know, you can imagine the chaos of trying to shoot on 16mm with five cameras moving around, trying to manage the chaos, and you see, you know, people rising in the pews, you see people in the choir who are so moved when she gets to Amazing Grace, and you see Cleveland James, like, just overcome with emotion.
He's a giant talent himself.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and one of many who, you know, were collaborating with Aretha Franklin in the production of what is now considered, you know, her signature masterpiece, you know, this album. And the film is just such a worthy, you just watch it and you completely feel as if you were there, even though the editing is, you know, you can see it's been stitched together from many different sources. It has almost the flow of a single unmediated take. It's just, and I think that's partly the craftsmanship with which it was shot and with which Pollack shot it, but it's also just the sustaining power of that music. I mean, you just, and Aretha, who's just standing there singing sometimes, and, you know, she's beaded with sweat, and you're watching her, you can't take her eyes off her, and yet she seems to just have this sort of otherworldly calm about her, like she's channeling, you know. Of course, I mean, how she did what she did is a mystery that none of us will ever know, but it truly does feel like you are touching the divine while watching this movie.
Amazing Grace. I've got the vinyl, the double record set, and I've pretty much worn the grooves out over the years on my Spotify list now. Amazing Grace, Sydney Pollack directing. It does not have a distributor. We make that note so that hopefully someone picks it up. The film, one-week Oscar-qualifying, Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena, Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. It's unrated. Shoah Four Sisters is a distillation of four women interviewed by the recently deceased director Claude Lanzmann, who did the classic 9.5-hour Shoah documentary of the early 1980s. Christy, tell us about how this sort of plays off of the original doc.
So these are interviews that Claude Lanzmann did with four women who are not related to each other. They are all from different parts of the world. Two of them were Polish, one was Czech, one was from Transylvania. And these are interviews that did not make it into Shoah. And he, you know, has done various sort of spin-offs of Shoah over the years. And these are four women whose stories he collected together to just sit down and describe what happened, you know, how they survived the Holocaust. And each woman is clear-eyed and understated and tells these horrific stories in just the calmest of demeanors, and tears do come eventually, and some conflicted feelings do emerge eventually. A couple of women are understandably experiencing some survivor's guilt. All four of these women are the lone survivors of their respective families, and his interviewing style is just simple and steady, and he's just having a conversation, and the camera will hold on a woman as she's telling a long story. They're all really vividly detailed. Like, it's like it was yesterday still. You can imagine that these experiences and these horrors are just seared into every fiber of your being, and so it's as clear as if it had happened yesterday, although at this point it had been several decades when these interviews took place. And he'll push in ever so slightly as the woman is, you know, reaching a point in a story that's clearly gaining some drama, some momentum. But it's, if we may go back to the unshowy showiness we were talking about earlier, it's not showy. It actually makes you feel as if you are leaning in, as you would if a woman like this were in front of you telling you this personal and very, very sad story. So it's 4.5 hours long. It's four individual films. The first one is 1.5 hours long, and the rest are about an hour. And they're in various languages. And then he cuts away to himself sometimes, you know, just sitting there smoking and asking questions. And it's really intimate and really powerful. And it's the conversations seem rather simple in the beginning because it's kind of getting to know you stuff, like how did you meet your husband and what was your father's profession? But eventually the questioning gets really serious and the cumulative result is just devastating. So I know it sounds like an Eat Your Vegetables kind of movie to go to, you know, 4.5 more hours of Showa, but it's really valuable.
And the original Showa at 9.5 hours is a must-see, I think,
yes,
for people who it's important to know the story of the Holocaust, and as well as for film critics to see the power of a film. It's extraordinary. Showa, Four Sisters from Claude Lanzmann, who died earlier this year. I believe he was 92 years of age and making documentaries up till the end. Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills, Lemley's Town Center in Encino. The movie is unrated. Coming up, we'll hear what Charles thought of the documentary The World Before Your Feet. And we'll hear Christy tell us about The Cleaners, a German documentary about digital scavengers. What's that? She'll tell us all about it. It's coming up right here on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We hope you're having a terrific Thanksgiving weekend. I'll be back with you in just 1 minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Our critics this week are Charles Solomon, Justin Chang, and Christy Lemire. Next, The World Before Your Feet, a documentary takes us to the five boroughs of New York City. Jeremy Workman, the director. Charles?
Well, as it's gotten cheaper and easier to make documentaries with, you know, limited resources, we're now getting the damn fool stunt school of filmmaking. Matt Green, he's 37. He doesn't have a job. He's content to live by pet sitting or just imposing on his friends. And he sets out to walk every block in New York. He doesn't really have a coherent reason as to why, but he sees himself as sort of some Zen visionary, just meeting people and interacting with the city. And you think, you know, couldn't he do something productive with his life? Apparently not.
Well, and he somehow how does he support himself? Do you
know? Occasional pet sitting and I guess sponging off his friends, because he makes a big point of saying, I don't have an apartment. And you see him staying with various people.
Sorry, couch surface.
Yeah, and you see him sitting with other people's cats. And I guess it's satisfying for him.
The World Before Your Feet is at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. It's unrated. The German documentary The Cleaners tells the story of digital scavengers. It's directed by Hans Block and Moritz Riesvik. What do you think, Christy?
So this is really fascinating, and it's a chilling topic that I did not ever know existed, but in retrospect, it makes total sense. So there's this whole secret syndicate of companies that are employed by search engines and social media platforms to, quote unquote, scrub them of offensive content, be it child pornography or terrorist imagery or beheadings. And they sit in cubicles and they go through photos or videos and just say, ignore, ignore, delete, delete, ignore, delete. And they are the arbiters of what we can and cannot see. And which is amazing because there's still so much that exists out there clearly, which is offensive or threatening or shocking or whatever. And it raises lots of interesting questions about freedom of speech and what is art and what is not. There's an artist here in Los Angeles who did a painting of Donald Trump during the presidential campaign. And it's of him. He's a nude and he's got a really tiny little penis. And the whole point was to show that he's not as powerful as he wants to be. That was shared everywhere and then taken down because it was deemed it was a nude image. And so it was taken down. So it's a matter of what is art, what is not. Questions of privacy, questions of territoriality, what belongs to you online, what doesn't. So I did not know that any of this existed. The largest one is in Manila. So a lot of it takes place in Manila. And you see people who are really living in sad, poor conditions, who this is their source of income under Duterte.
How did they psychologically deal with this? I mean, they're seeing horrible acts of violence and abuse and unspeakable things that people post. How do they deal with that?
Well, some people just can't take it after a while and they quit the job. One person whose job it was to entirely look for suicides online ended up hanging himself in front of his laptop because he just watched, you know, too many horrific images of, you know, live streams of people trying to kill themselves or actually killing themselves. So it's disturbing. I had no idea this existed, but it does.
The Cleaners, the documentary, German made from Hans Block, Moritz Riesewick. It's unrated, Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Of Fathers and Sons, German, Lebanese, Syrian documentary, which is directed by Talal Deraki. Christy, what'd you think?
Here's another documentary with some disturbing content in it. Talal Deraki is a Syrian filmmaker who embedded himself with a family kind of undercover. He said he was a war photographer, and he went back to northern Syria to spend a couple of years with a family. We mostly see this father who is a jihadist and his three little boys, two of whom are named Osama and Muhammad after Muhammad Atta. And the access is what's interesting here. There are some shocking revelations here and there as far as what these impressionable boys do and say. You know, you see them throwing rocks at girls who are in school. These boys aren't in school. The father teaches them how to survive and find landmines and that kind of thing. He's a landmine expert. But if they throw rocks at girls and they say awful things and you hear him listening to, you know, propaganda in his car and, you know, these little sponges are then going to go out into the world and follow in those footsteps. And I don't know that's necessarily revelatory, but it's the access is interesting.
Being immersed in it's got to be tough. Justin.
Really quickly, yeah, I would just completely agree with that. And the access is extraordinary. You keep, you know, I find a lot of times with how did they get that moment? And with this one where it's just there's so much low boil tension in every moment. And as you're watching, as they're going to, you know, these kind of jihadist training camps and you see shots of the regimens that they go through and the camera just sort of sits there very quietly observing. It's quite chilling.
The film of Fathers and Sons, unrated, Lemley's Music Hall, Beverly Hills. The Christmas Chronicles, a comedy adventure film starring Kurt Russell, Judah Lewis, and Darby Camp. Clay Cadis is the director, Matt Lieberman, the screenwriter. Christy?
This is the mental palate cleanser we all need right now. Kurt Russell is Santa Claus. And it's really fun, you know. This brother and sister who don't get along. It's Christmas. Their mom has to work. The father died earlier that year, so it's a sad Christmas. And they decide to stay awake all night to stake out Santa and shoot video and catch him coming down the chimney. And they end up really, truly finding Santa and, like, hitching a ride on his sleigh and causing all kinds of mayhem. It was produced by Chris Columbus, who notably did the first couple of Harry Potter movies, but he also did Home Alone and he did Adventures in Babysitting, and it feels a lot like those kinds of movies. The two young actors in it, Darby Camp and Judah Lewis, are very good, and Kurt Russell just having a blast as kind of an anachronistic Santa. He hates the fact that he's always depicted as jolly with a big, you know, belly full of jelly, whatever. He's like, I am not that fat. I do not look like that. It's fun. I would say it's streaming on Netflix. If you need to have your family do something while they are waiting for turkey, or if you're ready to immerse yourself in Christmas, this is a cute, fun family film.
Actually, the plot sounds like this version, the last version of The Grinch.
The animated Grinch?
Yeah, the one where the kid is trying to catch Santa Claus, et cetera.
The Christmas Chronicle starring Kurt Russell. It's streaming on Netflix and it's unrated. Becoming Astrid, a Swedish film starring Alba August. It's directed by Pernil Fischer Christensen. Christy, quick review of Becoming Astrid.
Very quickly, this is a biopic about Astrid Lindgren, who was a beloved children's author who most notably created the character of Pippi Longstocking. It is a very conventionally structured but well-acted biopic, and Alba August, who daughter of Pernilla August, is very good in it. A very lively, vibrant performance. She thinks for herself. She's kind of rebellious, and it's about how she asserts herself and becomes a young mom and becomes an author. It's the beginning of her life as an author.
Becoming Astrid is unrated at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. We wish you a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. Hope you're having a terrific time over these days. And we invite you to join us, of course, at our usual times for Film Week right here on 89.3 KPCC. I hope you'll come visit us in person Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel. Our next Film Week screening, it's The Artist, the wonderful silent modern classic, Oscar-winning Best Picture of 2011. We'll screen it in the afternoon, 1 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. After the screening, our Film Week critics will be with me, and we'll talk about the movie. Hope you can attend. Have a great rest of your day.